Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett. Unfortunately, I'm traveling alone. Manny Barling, my co-host, is out of town, and with it being a long weekend, we decided we'd just replay an encore presentation from last week.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my very good friend, veteran trial lawyer Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hi, Simon. How are you doing? We're having a cool, breezy, and beautiful day in Southern California.
Well, as you probably have seen on the news, Picayune, the sleepy little town that it is in the direct path of Hurricane Isaac. The good news is that we're far enough inland that we don't have to worry about storm surge, just a lot of wind and rain. And, you know, I'm always happy when services are proactive in times of potential problems. For example, DirecTV, which is the satellite company we use, has already stopped the satellite reception, and it's not even raining here. Bad news is they've elected to come out on Tuesday morning to fix the problem. Now, Tuesday should be the day that we get hit. Now, that's good planning. So that's how my day's going.
Well, you know, we haven't touched on the fact the Republican National Convention is scheduled to start in Tampa, and I find it interesting. Apparently, the religious fundamentalists got it diverted to your neighborhood, Simon. So let's introduce our guest before we go on to an interesting show today. Of course, we have from Ohio someone who's going to try to keep us grounded, Sam Moffey, noted author, bon vivant, and wingmaker and restaurant owner, and I'm just dying to try your wings. When I get to Youngstown, I'm heading straight to your place for some wings.
So Bob Dylan's coming tomorrow to get some.
Oh, I wish I could be there.
No, he's playing in Youngstown. He thinks it's Greenwich Village, but we're going to get away with it.
Greenwich Village, it's not, my friend. In the meantime, we have with us also Peter Haven, our resident voice of reason. And Peter, today, I don't know if he can be a voice of reason with the show we're doing, but I know he's going to try very hard. Peter, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you very much.
And to fill the crowd today, we have author, writer, and grad student, Ashley Brooks, who's I don't want to call you a retired nurse, Ashley, because you do nurse from time to time, and she also doubles as my wife when she's willing to put up with me. And Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I'm a nurse for Manny Barling. He has a full-time private duty staff. That's me.
And of course, gentlemen, you know, nursing also includes such important activities as, honey, could you give me a beer while you're by the refrigerator? So I want you to know, Sam, there's a Midwestern guy in me somewhere.
He made sure that he married an Irish nurse.
So, gentlemen, we're going to do a show today, to our listeners, also on the issue of rape, abortion, and the 2012 election. And I'm sure that only people in darkest Africa without a satellite dish are the only ones who don't know that Todd Akin issued some remarks that are probably the most insulting to women I've heard in, a couple of dozen years, involving rape. And we'll get to them in a few moments, but I just want to cover a little bit about him so you understand why we're discussing that. He was actually born in New York City and grew up in St. Louis, and his father was a three-time third member of his family to graduate from Harvard, and he went to the Polytechnic Institute in Worcester, Mass., which is much like MIT, and he holds a BS in engineering. So this guy is a science major with a science degree, but then he went to the Covenant Theology Seminary and got a master's in divinity. Covenant Theology Seminary is a conservative school that ranks with Bob Jones and the notorious school in North Carolina, who had its nonprofit status revoked for teaching white supremacy and racism. And they're not far behind him, in my opinion. So he spent a lot of time in the Missouri House, won an election a number of times, but listen to what he did. He advocated for homeschool rights. He advocated for carrying concealed weapons, I guess so the girls can carry the weapons around the house. He fought all tax increases. He's against casino companies, any form of gambling, and has actually waged a war against it, not only in the state, but also in the federal government. And what I found most interesting was that he voted against funding of school nurses. Then ultimately, when the bills passed, he refused to have anything to do with it because it didn't prohibit them from providing sources for information about abortion for students. So he got elected to Congress, and he just kept on fighting abortion and basically fighting gambling. And he authored the Protect the Pledge of Allegiance Act. He has fought everybody's changes of the change of allegiance. And I've got to close with this. To talk about putting your foot in the mouth, in about a year ago, he objected to NBC's removal of some words under God from a video clip of school students reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, which we all know is a major dispute in our country. But what does he say about it? Quote, NBC has a long record of being liberal. And at the heart of liberalism really is a hatred for God and the belief that government should replace God. So now moving over from attacking liberals who now become atheists because they support abortions, he's now attacking women by trying to parse the word rape into saying there's good rapes, bad rapes, rapes, some that make you pregnant, some that don't. But while we have a Republican Party like to space away from him, the fact is that he's espousing the majority view of the Republican Party. And I know on your side, Sam, you support many of these views. I don't know what your position on abortion is, and so nobody misunderstands all of us. I'll start with my comments. I personally am against abortion. I confronted that issue when it was illegal, and I was in school. My wife got pregnant while I was in college, and I had to make
your other wife.
My other wife from another world. And I had that child, and again in 1970, I was in law school when my first wife became pregnant again, and I had that same decision to make, and I elected. I could not do it. Some of it's my Catholic school growth and all the rest, but I could not do it. But never in my life have I felt I had a right to speak for someone else and tell someone else what to do with their life. And what I see going on is, even though I don't personally support abortion and I personally would not do it, I don't have a right to tell any woman listening to this show or any woman in the United States of America what she can do with her body, what she can do with her life, and what she's willing to chain herself with the rest of her life. And so, Sam, tell me, how do people in Ohio these days feel about abortion issues?
Well, personally, I support the law of the land, which is Roe versus Wade. Women have the right to do whatever they want to do with their bodies, you know. And I think it's a good law because I myself, when I was, as I told you before, Manny, privately during the week, when I was 16 years of age, I got a girl pregnant. She was 15, and I'm grateful that we had an abortion. She had decided to, of course, and I backed it up. Both my parents and her parents did, too. It was the right thing to do. I say that to some people. Their jaws drop, and they want to punt. They want to punt me over, you know, to the moon. It's like, you know, Ralph Cramden. But that was, you know, heck, I'm 52, so it was 36 years ago, and they still get mad. I would say Ohio is probably split right down the middle, 50-50, just like about people who are pro-choice and people who are, you know, anti-abortion and all that. And what I've always said is we're a nation of laws, and here I am talking to all the lawyers. It's been made law by the Supreme Court. Let's deal with that. It should be a non-issue. I'm amazed that people, Republicans, and there are some Democrats, too, who use it to, for, you know, get votes. get campaign contributions and whatnot and make it a major issue when our country's falling apart economically.
Yeah. And, Peter, what is your observation growing up and experiences with this?
Well, I think it's a very complicated subject, and the way the Supreme Court addressed it in Roe versus Wade, to my way of thinking, was the only sensible way to address it. And the decision is actually more complicated than I think we frequently give it credit for. But they took a trimester approach. I've never had any direct personal experiences with abortion, but generally speaking, you know, I believe that women should have the right to choose how to deal with their bodies. I grew up with three sisters and a mother, so, you know, I was told what to do and I listened. And, you know, I'm generally in favor of a woman's right to choose.
And interesting enough, Ashley, I would like you to talk to us from your perspective as a nurse. I know you spent your younger days working in disadvantaged areas, and particularly in Chicago where you worked in poverty areas. And so you have a lot of a personal experience with observing women coming in the emergency room, victims of rape. And I wish you would share those with our listeners.
Here, as Peter was saying, there's such a wide range. And there is a wide range of what I saw from the rape victims and the tremendous pain, the humiliation, the horrible after events of what happened to this person, the actual physical aspect of where a person is actually, really thinks, oh, well, you know, this is, when I listen to Todd Atkins talk, rape is rape, you know. I agree with Obama. Rape is rape. It is rape is rape is rape. There's no, you can't just say there's going to be lines between all this rape. I mean, the very first rape I ever saw in that emergency room was somebody took a broomstick and shoved it up this woman. And she went to surgery and died a few days later from sepsis. So I have seen one extreme to the other of what human beings will do to one another. And for this man to be in his glass house and make a decision about any woman at all or make any judgment call on any woman at all, which is how I viewed his point of view from the rape, you know, it's horrible. It's horrible. And the percentage of children, which we'll get into later in the show, who have been raped, and the things that I have seen in my lifetime, you know, I think this man should be forced to go in to Cook County and sit there and watch people and watch and sit in on the rapes. And I think every person who's pro, you know, anti-abortion should go in and watch every single woman who has had to come into that emergency room or go into some of the homes of some of the people who have been too terrified to go into the emergency room.
Yeah, and I want to shift over to the legal side of it by telling a story that's similar but different. And going to law school, and this may have been true for you, Peter, in my time, there were less liability concerns, so we were taken on tours of, like, the morgue. My recollection is 20 of us going to the morgue, and the minute he made that first cut in the, you know, on an autopsy, about five people fell over, and my sarcastic friend eating a Snickers, who went on to be a famous prosecutor in L.A., leaned to me and said, "Those boys aren't for criminal law." And I started laughing. And he convinced me to take my son, who he dearly loved, to the jails while he was still young. So I was allowed to take my 14-year-old son on a tour of what's called, I forget, it wasn't the L.A. County Jail, it was a women's jail, Sybil Brand Institute. And I want to tell you, the first time that jail door slammed behind him, I thought he'd jump 2 feet. And by the time he left there, he wouldn't think about stealing anything. He wouldn't think about doing anything illegal. And he led a straight and narrow life because the thought of being in one of those jails was so horrifying to him. And I make that observation about men who live in glass houses, which is an interesting description of them, Ashley, who come to these religious convictions, and even women, because I know a great many women who support abortion who are happily married, 37 years, living in wealthy neighborhoods, never driven to South L.A., never go anywhere where they're in danger, have never been exposed to anyone who's been raped, and they are anti-abortion until someone around them is raped. And I think that's a big issue. And I'm not sure other people, Peter, have you had that experience where you were allowed to tour jails and the morgue and other places when you were in school?
I didn't have that experience when I was in school, but I did, ironically enough, take two depositions in state prisons, and it was on a rape case. It was on a civil rape case, and it was an experience I will never forget. And as if you had any less incentive to go to jail before you'd actually seen something like that, having seen it only confirms, you know, that you wouldn't want to be there. And the men that I deposed, they were each basically sentenced to life in jail. For the
Okay. The question I have is this Todd Akin guy seems to have absolutely no friends whatsoever. I mean, he won't stand aside, which is what the Republicans would love him to do, dearly love him to do. I'm sure they will pay all of the fees required. he came out with this comment, legitimate rape. What the hell is a legitimate rape?
Well, that's the issue. There's no such thing except in his very narrow mind. It doesn't exist.
Well, you know, I pulled up something from the CDC, which really sort of astounded me, and I thought, well, maybe this is where he's getting it from. And I know we're not talking about certain acts and laws, whenever, because it's such a complex area. From what talking to Manny and understanding the laws, it's too complex. But what got me was when the first thing I saw was sexual violence, including rape, is preventable. So if you think sexual violence, including rape, is preventable, then who's to blame? And this was recognized by Congress. That's when they passed the Violence Against Women in 1994. So if you're saying, Congress is saying, and this is how I interpreted it, and then please, Peter, correct me, Manny or Peter, sexual violence, including rape, is preventable. So if Congress votes it's preventable, then someone is to blame. Therefore, a Todd Akin's comment actually does make sense.
Well, first of all, I want to know, I never read that act, but it made me wonder. I wonder if it's true that Congress was going to fund chastity belts, because only a really good chastity belt would be the only thing I could think that would save it.
Well, they're saying that they have rape prevention, education programs through the CDC. It's like, what are they talking about? did they leave their
It's Congress, what do you expect?
Well,
I think he goes one step further, and Manny now gave me his background on in the listening audience about his divinity in that school. Now it makes sense where I think he's coming from. I mean, I think a lot of these crazy religious zealots that are in politics are coming from. And I think he goes to the point, the child, even if it's from rape, that's more important. So the child's innocent. You know, they get this argument out, at least it comes to me, when they say, well, the rapist rapes the woman, they have the baby, we have to protect the baby. Even though the mother didn't want it, the mother of the baby didn't want it, it was conceived by violence, the rapist probably has nothing to do with the child. But this guy, in his one narrow thinking, as you said, Manny, is he's protecting that child, even though the mother doesn't want it, he wants it.
I agree. It's a great trip. I want to raise one thing, though, quickly to explain, answer Simon's question. I read an interesting piece in the Washington Post about how Mitt Romney's rejected Akin, et cetera. And they went through the archives from Romney's previous presidential bid, and they show that Romney historically supported the person who's the source of Akin's theory. His name is Dr. Jack Wilkie. He's the father of the anti-abortion movement. I remember reading about him years ago. He was the president of the National Right to Life Committee. He was what they call a, quote, an important surrogate for Romney's 2008 presidential bid. He's often cited, according to this article, for the theory that rape-related pregnancies are rare, This theory is used by the anti-abortion advocates to argue against abortion laws.
Now, who is this guy, man?
His name is Jack Wilkie with two L's, and I remember reading about them. And he says that this is Wilkie's theory, because I pulled it up. Wilkie believes that trauma caused by violent rape causes a woman's reproductive system to shut down. He presents his belief as fact in educational materials, including a book about abortion, a website called abortionfacts.com. And, you know, even though everybody's...
Wait a minute, he has a book out on this?
Yes. And he operates a site, which you can look up, called abortionfacts.com. And this is where the word legitimate rape comes from, is from his book, okay? And it turns out that Romney he's been a big supporter of Romney and helped Romney with his platform for 2008 when he ran. And Wilkie, by the way, is quoted as saying that Romney is the only candidate to lead our pro-life and pro-family conservative movement to victory. So when I hear Romney, you know, castigate, it should be the other one, castrate,
yes.
Then, you know, I got to tell you, I think there's a little bit of talking out of both sides of his mouth. And after reading this article, I did some research, and it's basically what a number of sources agree is the source of all this, so it's not some liberal movement to somehow defame this guy. He apparently has a long history of this.
Yes.
It's a Wilkie. Yeah, Wilkie. Dr. Jack Wilkie, who's written this book that apparently both Aiken and Romney are supporters of. And if Romney's not a supporter of it, then I wonder why Aiken was so strongly involved with his election a few years ago. I mean,
I think Romney didn't win the nomination in 08 either. Maybe that's, you know, I don't know. I didn't follow.
That's a good point.
I think someone needs to chop off his Wilkie.
That is absolutely unfounded science. I mean, it's so unfounded that I can't even believe somebody put a book out there to treat it like it is founded information. And if they're putting this out, this book goes out to churches. This book goes out into, you know, the push to get people to not do abortions, which, you know, and I'm not saying I'm pro-abortion or I'm not about pro-abortion. What I am saying, though, is it's about the health of the individual, whether it's a mental health, whether it's a health and the health of the future of that child. So, I mean, for him to come out with this book, and that is so unfounded. You know, it's up there, for me, it's up there when they were saying that false rape, there was a whole thing on false rape, and I decided I'm going to go look this thing up. And this I'll speak quickly on. Two of the top five cities in the United States with the most unfounded, false, or baseless report of rapes was in New Orleans and Baltimore. And this, again, goes back to Todd Atkins that, you know, not all rape is rape, and you know, these women must be making it up. Percentage of rape reports was unfounded in New Orleans in 2008 at 60%. Percentage of rape unfounded in Baltimore in 2009. 32%. Now, these are decisions made by the police force, okay? Percentage of actual estimated false rape in any given year, according to the research study, was 2 to 8%. Hard to account for what happened in New Orleans and Baltimore, but that's okay. So then, in the rape reports deemed unfounded by the FBI in 2006 was 5%. Now, I went on to see the fact that I saw something, and I went, oh, my gosh, this is amazing to me. Unfounded rape in Philadelphia in 1983 was 52%. The year Philadelphia was forced to clean up its rape reporting practice in 1999, they discovered it was 10%. Philadelphia Sex Crime Unit used to call these people the Lying Bitches Unit. Reasons women lie about rape, according to Philadelphia Police Department 1984, is revenge, free abortion, covering up their pregnancy, infidelity, lost money, sexual promiscuity. I mean, to me, you know, people came forward and signed letters to the FBI to please change the definition of rape. And they were all forcing this issue because of the number of people who were making the decision in the police department and across the country that that person wasn't raped. They must be lying. And when I read this about the Philadelphia Police Department calling Sex City's sex crime unit, calling it the lying bitches unit, this goes back to what we just heard Todd Atkins declaring. Not all
right.
rape is rape.
Ashley, I have to ask you this question. Rape is one of the vilest crimes that can be committed, but it's undoubtedly one of the hardest crimes to actually get good statistics on, because women tend to not want to come forward.
Absolutely.
Well, that's not entirely accurate, Simon. Let's go to the core of this. Rape statistics are manipulated because they have to report them to the federal government, who publishes national statistics, and where your city sits on those national statistics vis-a-vis rape statistics has a great deal to do with not only funding, but civil pride, the position of the police chief. So it has become a political football. So New Orleans, I think, is the leader of the pack in deceitful activity. For a long time, anything that was marginal, they got rid of because it wasn't in their statistical best interest for anyone to admit that level of rape was going on. So a lot of the statistics are being done for no other reason than to conceal the truth to prevent criticism on a national level.
Okay, but
Department of Justice estimates how many women are actually raped each year? 300,000. Number of arrests for rape in 2007, 23,307. Percentage of rapes that result in incarceration, 35%. Not a lot.
No, and that's really the key here. Rape is a far more common crime than we hear about. And
not in Chicago.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
It is. Now, the problem with it is, again, some jurisdictions are faithfully honest to making the reports. Others are not.
Are you saying they lie on the statistics to, like, all these agencies do to force funding or maybe to cut funding or to get more money and or keep our reputation intact as a because New Orleans is a big tourist attraction?
Well, so, wait a minute. It's not just New Orleans, and I don't want to single out New Orleans. It's probably 90% of the jurisdictions in our country. That is the chronic problem with police stats. And the same is true, by the way, with why a lot of times they knock down felony assaults to misdemeanors because they want to alter their statistics. And having nice little pretty statistics is one of the most important things in controlling violence in your city. And, for example, you will hear stats will come out and say, well, this year this kind of violence was down in our area when, in fact, it may well have been up because they just don't want anyone to know the truth.
Right.
That's what's going on, Sam.
I agree with you. I'd love to know how can we, before when abortion was illegal, how many doctors butchered, you know, a poor woman went to go get a back, what do they call them, back alley abortions? And probably got, you know, died on the table or whatever. And I know, man, you're a big movie buff. All I can think about while we're talking about this in the back alley abortions is a great movie with Kirk Douglas called Detective Story. That was like in the late 40s, and they made a big issue out of that.
It was a play, and the movie was made in the early 50s, and it's an interesting subject that Hollywood took on. But no, I wanted to come back to the basic part about stats and all the rest of it. It is a very difficult thing for police to prosecute. Every state has a different way of prosecuting it, and have different ways to gather evidence and do a variety of other things along the road. And one of the things I want to ask you to talk about in a moment is what it's like to be in an emergency room and deal with that. But they make it very, very difficult to gather evidence to prosecute. A lot of states make it very, very difficult. And oddly enough, up until about 1936, there was no discussion whatsoever about the woman. It was just a flat, simple, did he rape her, didn't he rape her, he's going to jail, he's not. And there was none of the discussion you see now about whether she was a good person, did she egg him on. And there was a legendary case in Los Angeles called the People versus Pantages, the owner of the Pantages movie chain theater, where he was accused of rape, and it was actually was a case of a false claim of rape that someone was put up to do to embarrass him. And a famous legal team of Jake Ehrlich and Jerry Giesler, two of the more famous California attorneys, defended Pantages and proved that this woman was, oh, I would say she was 4 or 5 inches taller than him and physically could probably beat the crap out of him in a fight. And it was really nonsensical to believe that he raped her. And yet he lost and went up to the Supreme Court, and they won the case. And he always bemoaned, particularly Jake Ehrlich, that it opened a door that he never intended to open, and then people ran with it. Then we started to see this history of oh, she's a bad person, or she egged him on. But before the middle 30s, that was never even an issue. So after that, various states adopted it, changed it, agreed with it, disagreed with it, and we went through a cycle where the laws across the U.S. about rape had changed so radically that it's not handled in two states alike, which is what I was Ashley was talking about in my discussion with her, is that so at the end of the day, none of us really can go from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and predict what they'll do. So that's another way they control it, Sam, is by controlling the way the cases are handled, which make an issue that women don't want to press because they feel the court system is unsympathetic and will embarrass them and treat them poorly. So, Ashley, tell us about your experience about evidence gathering and what goes on in an emergency room when a nurse is confronted with a rape patient.
You know, it's so extensive, Manny, that I'm going to do like a generic, okay, so that because of the extensive manner in which, you know, beginning to end, because it's such a sensitive thing, and it's caution from the close, caution from collecting the correct story, caution from, I'm sure people have seen this on TV with, you know, making sure that, you know, that correct specimens are collected, photographs have to be collected. If anywhere along that journey, from your collection, the medical profession's collection, to the actual end process of that collection, if one step is missed, that case can eventually get thrown out and the rapist can be, you know, excluded. Which means that, according to Todd Atkins, and according to the, you know, anti-abortionist people, this means that, say this is a child who's 11 years old, who has been raped, who is laying there, has had to go through the humiliation of this entire horrific experience, has now had to have a mental cold scope put up them, had to have all sorts of specimens and everything else taken, have to talk to police and go through all this trauma. Now this rapist is going to be let go. Now the child's pregnant. Oh, my goodness, she must have really wanted it, right, according to Todd Atkins, because conditions must have been really good down there for her to get pregnant. I mean, that's how absurd is that? So anywhere along the line, though, if there's a photograph missing, there's something that is not taken properly from head to toe. Now, the other concern then goes into medications, vaccines against hepatitis, vaccines against STD, medication for that, medication for gonorrhea, syphilis. There's going to have to be various other medications, you know, if anti-abortion, you know, medications given at that point, if the child has actually come in and this event has occurred, and not that I'm questioning the child at all, but, you know, permission would have to be given from the parents to actually give this medication. So you go through this whole thing. Now, some of the criminals have become very, very smart. And they know to use a condom, obviously. If they use a condom, their semen is not left behind and their DNA cannot be hopefully traced. That's their thought process. But, again, the child's going to have, or whoever, the adult's going to have this medication. And in giving this medication, there is a chance that, now they'll say, oh, won't happen. But we all know side effects of drugs and vaccines. And anybody who doesn't, please look it up. And there's a chance then that even if the parent says, no, you know what, I'm this person who doesn't believe in any of that, let my little 11-year-old who's even, you know, can die from this have this baby, you know, if he's pregnant, she's pregnant, rather. And so in the end, it's just a long, long process, and if one step's missing at all, it gets thrown out. And Manny, you and I talked about this. That's one of the problems, is the fact that if this anti-abortion happens, and you it's only if the child's been or the person's been raped, and that rape actually occurred. If the court doesn't, if the case doesn't go and doesn't, they don't find the rapist, and it doesn't go for a year, well, that person's going to have to carry that baby to term. We talked about that, Manny.
Yeah, right, and that's another issue. And by the way, as I said to Ashley, I would like to know what Aiken's position would be is if it were his wife raped or his 12-year-old daughter. Would he not seek an abortion for his 12-year-old daughter if she were raped? I have trouble with this, and how he can adopt this position without any sense of the reality of how it would affect himself or his family.
He gets votes.
And how about the other one, which I throw out, and this may be a racist statement, but what happens if his child is raped by a black criminal, and now he's confronted with his 12-year-old daughter should have a child by a black criminal.
With HIV.
Yeah,
let's throw a disease in there, too, because,
right.
You know, there you go.
District. I didn't get a chance. What is his district is like, where he's from? Obviously,
I couldn't hear you, Sam.
What's his
has
district
anybody
like?
Looked at his district? What?
Well, he comes from the west side of St. Louis, which is, I would describe, as the Tony Wonderful side of St. Louis. As you know, East St. Louis is a ghetto on the edge of the
right.
Illinois border. Some consider it the worst ghetto in the United States, worse than Harlem, South Los Angeles, et cetera. And so he doesn't seem to have too much sympathy for the other side of his town.
Well, the other side is just a complete, it's obviously, how many times has he been in he's been a congressman for how many years, Manny? How many
well,
years?
He was a state congressman, I think, from, I believe, from 88 to about 2000. He's been in the House
I think it's 14 years.
No, it's 2001 he took office.
Okay, and he won a primary, a very hotly contested primary, to win
right.
that Senate seat.
Right. He,
right. That was so, I mean, that's kind of, people had to have known what his hardcore issues were, right?
Well, first of all, if you've ever heard this story, he won the primary that occurred in a driving rainstorm that gave him some kind of political advantage because his wacko supporters were willing to show up in a rainstorm while others weren't. So it gave him somewhat of an advantage, which people have commented for a while. But he's held his office. Give him credit. He has not been voted out. But that also speaks to the people in his district, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And that's what I'm trying to find out. I don't know that much about him, except you know what he said, how stupid it was. And hopefully he'll. It's amazing to me someone thinks that way in today's in the year 2012. It's just
I agree with
me.
You. And you know what? The thing that got me too is that doesn't he read? I mean, does the man not read? All he had to do is pick up statistics to see. I mean, how about this one? Every 2 minutes, someone in the United States is sexually assaulted. Every 2 minutes. So
well,
again, what,
I think
all these people
that that's
want
okay because that the baby's going to be innocent, and he doesn't care about the victim. He cares about if there's a baby, that baby's innocent, and the state has to prepare for it. I never could understand that about the zealots. They always talk about government, not a small government. Yep, they want the government to outlaw abortion, and then who's going to take care of these? Take care of all these people, all these children? It's going to be the government, isn't it?
Well, 40%.
Where are all these people going? Where are all these unwanted children going to go?
40% of the rapes or assaults are under the age of 18. 15% of the sexual assault and rape victims are under the age of 12. 15%. And in that group, wait a minute, 29% are the age of 12 to 17. And I mean, it's just so ridiculous to me that 15%. Now, for him to ever make a statement about anything, he's going to qualify when somebody can have an abortion or qualify a rape. I mean, the next thing people are going to hear is, you know what, that drug that's going to prevent that child or that adult from having HIV or having gonorrhea or having syphilis, you know, we can't give that drug because it might hurt the baby they may possibly be carrying. Because if you take it one step, you're going to have to take it two steps. And one of the things I got from Dianne Feinstein when I went to see her years ago, and I wanted to become familiar with her because I kept listening to her, Manny, here in our state. And so when I went to see her, she's also an RN, and her recollection, and Sam, you brought this up, her recollection of she fought to get the abortion laws into the various areas of California and to get this things pushed as much as she could, not because she's atheist, not because she's not Christian, because God knows I'm Christian. But I'll say one thing. She saw so many of the girls in her dorm and people that she knew with coat hangers that destroyed them, perforated them, or had to go down the back alleys and were and died. You know, so she fought because she knew, you know, a man should never make a statement like that. Never. And for people to be in their perfect little worlds and not actually realize there is another, there's human beings out there that need help.
And, man, he went to Harvard, you said?
Pardon me?
He went to he's Harvard educated?
No, his father, apparently his father and grandfather are both Harvard educated. His father was the president of a family-owned steel company, and when he got out of school, he went to work in the steel company, and that's what he did. So he's basically had a silver spoon in all of his life, and never worked. I'm sure he's never worked in any kind of minority area, nor did he ever get his hands dirty with anything that was required by doing that. And so, at the end of the day, you know, he has this what I call holier than thou, the religious fanatic's viewpoint about so many things, particularly the poor, because I'm sure he's not sympathetic to the poor any more than he is to women who are raped.
Well, it's amazing, you know, from someone from, you know, I would think St. Louis, because he's a part of St. Louis that is, you know, educated culture, you know, and all that stuff. He would never be a congressperson from that area. That's mind-boggling.
Well, yes, there's parts of Missouri that are extremely conservative from a religious standpoint, and he appeals to a certain audience. And this is part of why I say to you sometimes a small amount of people in the U.S. have too much ability to affect elections and decisions in comparison to the number of people they represent. So here's a guy who represents a small district in the U.S. with a very small voting population, and yet what he says is posted around the country as if it's the word of the land. And I think that's one of the dangers. And, in fact, I was just reading, Ashley, a bit out of Frank Capra's autobiography about how he goes on, and this is some 50 years ago, about how TV is creating instant celebrities and how people can't wait to use television so they could advance their own goals and words without and have their moments of fame. And he hadn't even got into the famous quote of your 15 minutes of fame and saw this as a danger in our country because of the numbers and types of people who would be able to foster opinions that were just really dangerous to society.
Okay, will Todd Akin pull out of the race? The race for getting control of the Senate seems to very much revolve around him. The Republicans don't want him. They know he's bad news. Do you think that he's going to walk away?
Of course not. And he's not going to walk away for what reasons that Sam just raised, is that when you look at the breakdown of the people who vote for him, he probably thinks, my constituency doesn't care. They're going to vote for me anyway. Don't you agree, Sam?
I think there is, but I don't think he wants to walk away. I think the Republican Party is going to drag him out of there. So he doesn't want to, but he's going to be forced out of there.
You really think so, huh?
Yes, I really do. I was very impressed. You know, look, Missouri, this Senate race, you know, I know the Democrats and the media tried to put, you know, make it like he was the running mate. You know, and I
oh, yeah, of course.
And that's terrible. And it would happen the other side, too. And that's terrible, too. But I do applaud Romney and Ryan for coming out and trying to get them out right away, and other Republicans. And, you know, sometimes we let, you know, I've seen how other Democrats, I want to, you know, went to support Charlie Rangel, and he's still there. Okay, and I'm not comparing these two guys at all, comparing what they believe. But, you know, Rangel's a crook, but the Democratic parties and, you know, rallied around him for the most part, or really didn't go out of their way to get rid of him. But here you had people stand up and say, this guy's a moron, he's an idiot, he's going to hurt us. You know, we've got to cut him, you know, we've got to cut him loose. And I do believe that, because as Simon said, this could decide the makeup of the Senate, this seat in Missouri. And I believe he was winning in the polls till he stuck both feet in his mouth.
But
they'll force him out of there. Koch brothers pulled their funding from him.
What?
Ashley, go ahead.
Thank you. It's okay, I'm like a little kid, I can't wait.
We're ready for your close-up, Ashley.
Okay, great. I'm sorry, Sam. You just got me going.
Well, jump in. What was it you were dying to say?
I forgot now. It's okay.
Well, Sam was talking.
I do that to her once in a while myself.
Sam was talking about the fact that he thinks he'll be pushed out. And Ashley, you were saying, "Don't you think?"
Yes, I know.
As if to express a contrary point of view, and
yeah,
I can't wait to
contrary.
Hear it.
I'm going to just not say a word. I'm going to say it. Well, I think that, don't you think that the fact that Todd Atkins is actually only saying what the reality of what the Republican Party stands for? Because the Republican Party says, you know, they're so anti-abortion, that's been their platform, it's completely 100% their platform. We've got Romney who's running, who's saying, oh, I can get votes over here, let me run over here, and oh, yeah, oh, no, I'm anti-abortion, oh, over here, oh, I'm abortion, okay, maybe, possibly on certain rapes, but I get to make the call on it. And then you've got Ryan who's going, I'm totally Catholic, I'm absolutely anti-abortion, you know, oh, wait, no, I'm sorry, some abortions will allow it on certain cases. So essentially, I think in many respects, Todd Atkins, even though they want the Republican Party is walking away from him, I think in many respects he's actually viewing his voice is actually what Congress has been saying on the Republican side and what is actually being said. The truth, maybe if Romney ever could say the truth other than flip-flop it all over the place, or Ryan initially said. So my question is that, don't you think that he's actually just the voice of the reality of what the truth is? Because I don't know if we ever hear the truth.
Whoa, that's a good one.
All right, Peter, you go ahead. You tack that one.
Well, I think that a lot of what Ashley says is true with respect to the views of the Republican Party. And one of the things that people were talking about in the wake of Representative Aiken's comments were that he didn't say anything that isn't already a part of the GOP platform. And in fact, one of the things that immediately arose after these comments were made is that a prior draft of the so-called GOP platform had been circulated, and Romney, or perhaps Ryan, I forget who it was, had basically endorsed a draft of the platform that used the term forcible rape. Basically, in the same vein and with the same meaning that Aiken had used the term legitimate rape, and in that draft was circulated, and they later took out the word forcible. But the overall point is that I think there are many members of the Republican Party who basically share the point of view that Aiken expressed, which is that they want to find any way they can to be opposed to abortions under any circumstances. And the way it was expressed by Aiken is very unpalatable. I actually don't know to what extent the entire Republican Party embraces that same ideology. It seems to me that one of the issues the Republican Party has to face today is that there's a schism between more moderate views within the Republican Party and more conservative views. And I think that the birth of the Tea Party is a reflection of arch conservatives within the Republican ranks who are really trying to preserve those values. And personally, I think they're fighting a losing battle, but they're fighting. And the current GOP ticket that seems to be emerging is going to be an attempt to cater to those sort of Tea Party values. And I think they're going to lose a lot of more moderate Republican voters. And, you all know how I feel the election's going to turn out. That's sort of my thought among many, many thoughts that I've had as we've all been talking, because this is just a lightning rod subject and it always generates a lot of provocative thought.
Sam, I want to hear your thoughts, because you and I have kicked this back and forth and how much damage it would cause, because I do believe that the words are inappropriate. But get away from the words, as Peter says. It is fundamentally what I hear out of all of the Republicans, and I agree with him that this schism in the Republican Party with the Tea Partiers, because you say to me and others say to me, oh, they're just a branch of the Republicans. Well, they're like have battling cousins, because they began to branch away because they didn't agree with the rank-and-file Republicans specifically on these issues, and that is the genesis of how the Tea Party got started.
Yeah, the Tea Party was born out of the bailout to Wall Street and GM and Chrysler. That would have birthed that was the mother and father of the Tea Party, the bailout. Okay, so how you go from, and most of the people didn't want government, they didn't believe in that, and I know some people. I'm not in the Tea Party. I know some people who are. They never talk social issues with me. All they ever talk about, I hear them when they speak or whatnot. This is Columbiana Tumbler, Mahoning County. They talk about they want a small government, and it's almost libertarian. It's almost libertarian. It's not quite, because they do believe in they want Fortress America to be all over the world. Most of us all disagree with that. But that's where I differ with a lot of people in the Tea Party. I've never heard them, or they've ever come to me and talk social issues. Okay, and I know it's part of the plank, and as many of you and I kicked around via emails, I always tell people that in 2001, after 9/11, George Bush and the Republican Party were in total control of this country. Everyone had flags out, this and that. The Republican Party, invade Iraq, invade Afghanistan. They had the Supreme Court. They had everything. But they never tried to overturn Roe v. Now, they might have paid lip service to it, but if there was any time they wanted to take on Roe versus Wade, that was the time. They were in total control of the federal government everywhere, but they didn't. And I think it's a lightning rod issue, as Peter said, that just gets everyone all stirred up. It's a smokescreen, just like the left has, go get the banks, go get Wall Street, and they don't realize that the Democratic Party is funded just like the Republican Party by Wall Street, but it makes for great theater, and it's red meat for their bases. I just think, look, it's the law of the land, leave it alone, let's get on to the real issues that are destroying this country and about to plunge us into a Great Depression. It's going to be worse than the one in the 30s.
Okay, you bring up a great question, and I'm going to bounce it off Peter. Peter, let's pretend for a moment that Romney Ryan wins. Do you think that they'd be gutsy enough to bring up Roe v. Wade with the Supreme Court?
One of the things I think of is my dad always used to tell me there was a fine line between courage and stupidity. I think that if they win, they'll believe that they have a mandate to do pretty much whatever they want in the early part of their presidency, as many newly elected presidential administrations feel. The ability and bringing something up in a political context is often the easiest thing in the world to do. You know, you can try to sponsor legislation, you can try to bring a test case, and you could look to all your constituents and you say, oh, we tried, we did this, we tried that, the blankety blanks, you know what, shut us down again. So the short answer to your question is I think they could absolutely try. The more complicated question is what kind of success would they have? You know, it would take an appropriate test case to get to the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to actually have a chance to overturn Roe versus Wade, and that would take some time. It would take, I guess, some sort of legislative enactment to try to pass some sort of federal law that would deal with this issue, and that would take a lot of time as well. And I don't really think that either would have much likelihood of success.
I have a thought for you, Peter, on the legal side. I don't think that's the direction they're going, and they have been for a while. The direction is that they're trying to do it by cutting off federal aid, and by cutting off federal aid, they think they can stop abortion through that road. And it was evident because there was a case decided this week, you may have noticed, that permitted the use of stem cell research. And the big issue with that was that they claimed that, basically embryos from abortions are used and therefore it should not be supported by public money. And that's essentially what they're trying to do, is by raising those issues within a taxing consequence context, that they're able to get rid of the problem. And I believe there was the 90s Act somewhere in there that was passed about using embryos for abortions. And by the way, that's what Bush did. You may recall that Bush issued an edict in which he said that federal money could not be used for abortions that came from certain categories, which effectively wiped out almost everything available for doctors to use. And in that particular moment, this country dropped behind Europe in stem cell research, which we've not been able to recover from. And Ash and I dealt with this with ourselves and others during serious...
Manny, I just want to interrupt on that thought. Didn't Obama sign on the... I don't know, you're more on top of it, but didn't he reinstate that? I would think that he would have.
Yes, he did, but I'm talking about Republicans now, and so during that time, that was a subtle attack. And by the way, as a lawyer, I found it a very skillful and thoughtful and clever attack that I might well have thought of myself. So the fact is that they've just gotten more clever about it, and they have a right to do that. I'm not begrudging them. I disagree with them, but the fact is that's how they're attacking this issue, because a frontal attack isn't going to be successful for all the reasons I think Peter enumerated so skillfully.
Manny, I do absolutely resent it. I resent it because of the fact, and it goes like this. The fact that they are not in medicine, the fact that they don't have a degree, the fact that they are not, scientists, the fact that these people are making decisions that are going to impact somebody's life and death, life of saving an organ, life of just life itself. Having seen the things that I saw in Europe with stem cells, oh, my goodness. It was miraculous. It was God's work. And so to see 20 years of research on people and see the incredible impact and the positive things that happen with stem cells from scientific evaluation, from medical evaluation, and then to see what's happened in this country based on a Republican Party making a decision on things they have no business sticking their nose in, none, because they do not have the education in it. And I'm only limited. I'm a limited person. I can't imagine being the scientist who actually fully grasps every single one of the chemical breakdowns that happen. I mean, it's mind-boggling from the healing and the cures that can happen. And with the number of people that are sick in this country, that makes me sick, the fact that Republicans such as Bush or somebody else can come in and make a decision like that. Or Todd Atkins who can make a decision like he's making.
Well, let me interrupt you one thing. Just tell one story about the Chicago physician who had the physical and found out that he had a four-stage, I think it was pancreatic cancer.
Full-blown pancreatic cancer. He had 3 months before, he's a world-known famous doctor, so we'll leave it at that. 3 months before, Notre Dame grad. 3 months before, he had a full, complete medical exam approved by your insurance companies, because they're the doctors. They get to say okay or not on what you get to have treatments done on. So there is this man who has a full-blown treatment. 3 months later, finds out he has and has had full-blown pancreatic cancer. The man immediately goes out, gets stem cells,
Now, wait a minute. They told him to go home and go to hospital.
Oh, they told him go home and die. Get your stuff in order. You know, you're going to be dead in a few months if you live that long. And here's a man with two little children at home, young man. He immediately had to fly down to, and I'll leave that part open because I don't ever want to cause a problem in that area. He had to fly someplace else. He immediately got stem cells. He immediately flew to the clinic in Germany, continued on medications, because the first thing they did that they do differently than in this country is they treat the body as a whole. They started immediately to build up his immune system, to get his liver functioning, to get his pancreas functioning. And guess what? The man, last I heard, he lived 5 years. I don't know if he's still alive, but I know that the man lived 5 years. And that was the last I heard. So he could still be alive. He may have passed away. I don't want to go throwing out something I don't know fact on. But the fact that they were able to reverse that, and this man, I mean, I looked at him day one. It's like, oh, my gosh, you know, you better go home and get your things packed. But that stem cells reversed what was happening within him. And he is one of many, 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 many cases that I know of. So for the science in this country to be stalled and then scientists to have the blocking that goes on based on the Republican Party making decisions on science or making statements like all rape is preventable, come on. You know,
well, let me take it one step further. Okay, I support, no, I'm a Ron Paul, you know, right? And Ron Paul's a doctor, as you all know, and he's against abortion. But one of the things he said, and I think this is what we really come down to, is we have one party, Republican or Democrat, that gets in power, controls the federal government, controls the purse strings, and that's the way it is. He wanted to make it go back to the states. So then you have crazies that support this moron in Missouri. They could all, if Missouri wants to be not have abortions, then that's the way it is. But that doesn't mean a person who gets pregnant in Missouri can't go to the neighboring state, where it would probably be legal.
Well, that's
the
true.
Government's
but,
not
but wait a minute. You take someone in East St. Louis who can't afford to go to West St. Louis, who can't even afford a car and is struggling and may even be 15 years old. How the hell are they going to do that?
Well, I mean, but I'm sure. Okay, another way. I'm sure that, let's say that person can't get out of East St. Louis, okay? But the abortion clinic where it is legal would probably be, you know, more than willing to send someone to go get him. I'm just, you know, I'm going to be, I'll think, if there's a will, there's a way.
I believe there's only, in some states, and I forget whether it was Missouri or somewhere else, was down to only one abortion clinic in the state. Every one of those abortion clinics.
It's here in Mississippi.
It is Mississippi. And in every one of those states, those places are picketed daily, and they engage in the kind of conduct designed to stop abortion in any way they can. So, no, getting an abortion right now, I would describe as the equivalent of running the gauntlet.
I guess it's hard. You know, one, I lived through it. I'm not as bad as my girlfriend from way, way back did. But, you know, which is in Youngstown, and, you know, it was not a problem. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, and I don't want it to. I want people to be able to get them. But what I'm trying to say is, Ashley brings up a very good point. She's throwing out, like, I'm for anything that's going to make people healthier, extend lives, not hurt people, you know, so people don't have to be in pain. I mean, it's common sense. But these idiots who get in power, you know, Republicans or Democrats or both, seem to miss the boat. You know, they don't care. They care about their own power base and their own campaign contributions and getting reelected and playing to these bases and whatnot. Why everyone suffers, whether it's in East St. Louis or the south side of Youngstown. And you know, maybe we give them too much power. Maybe the federal government, well, I believe this, has way, way, way too much power, and therefore we can't get the things necessarily done that need to be done. You know, and because the states aren't in control, even the states are now waiting for the federal government Santa Claus money to come down to them, and that's the problem. We the people ship all this money to Washington, and they ship it and do anything they want with it, and it's not benefiting the people. There is enough money in this society to take care of all the problems, and it's not getting to where it's supposed to go. And that's
well, no, I got to jump in with something, because, Sam, you can't get away with that. I agree with you on the surface, except for one major problem with all this, and that is what they do, what they want with it, is fund endless defense spending, which goes in the pockets of a certain few in the U.S., and there's our number one problem.
Well,
I sent you that interesting graph about how we spend more money in defense than the entire world combined. So none of us in the States have any way to complain about it. And then I hear people like John McCain, and I hear Paul Ryan, and I've heard others say this too, that they don't care what we think as citizens. They know better than this. So here we have Paul Ryan, who has a lesser education than I do in terms of length of time in school, acting out this paternal role, telling me what that he knows what's best for me. And I find that repulsive. And I wonder if anyone else on this show finds that equally repulsive.
I think the whole federal, I think, you know, look, we're in a, have we declared a, we're in how many different countries are we in, wars are we in?
Yeah,
and
we haven't declared one war, have we?
When's the last time Congress declared war? Is it World War II?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
we didn't declare war in Vietnam. That's unconstitutional. We didn't declare war in Korea. We didn't declare war in Iraq. We went through the United Nations, which is, I don't see that in the United States Constitution. We're in Afghanistan. We're killing people with drones. Innocent people are getting killed. You know, and go on and on and on. Because you're right, Manny. I saw that graph you gave me. And I think that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Sam. The big question is, when is Romney or, his little friend Ryan going to say, oh, first thing we're going to do is get all of our kids out of Afghanistan?
Not going to do it.
No. Why not?
And either did Obama, who was the peace candidate, to defeat Hillary Clinton. He ran to the left.
No. Forget Obama. I mean, why won't he say, we're out of here? I mean,
I really hope that he does, Simon. It's financially, if this guy's a great businessman that everyone he says he is, looks at the balance sheet, not just in the cost of lives. And there were 31 Americans killed last week in Afghanistan. We're talking about this idiot in Missouri. That really irks me because my son's in the military. And then I hear he gets the call that, hey, the rumors are heading around that, oh, my God, there might be chemical weapons in Syria, just like they had weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And everyone's starting to think, oh, no, now we're going to be going, that's the excuse to go into Syria. And I hope that this guy looks at the balance sheet and says enough with the, forget about the loss in blood, the poor men and women who are surviving these horrific IEDs and coming back maimed for life, and get the hell out of the war. And spend that money where we need it.
Sam, I want to point out something. There's never been a debate about chemical weapons in Syria. They were sold to them by Russia, among other people. And it's not one of the world's great secrets. They're there, and nobody can really deny it.
But, Manny, don't you think it's still a proxy war that's happening in Syria right now, even though people don't realize it? There's really a proxy war because we're supporting them with weapons, aren't we?
No. I wouldn't consider a Syria war a proxy war of ours, but I would consider it a proxy war of all people, Iran, because Iran is the biggest fueler of weapons and other things, as well as Russia. And, you know, the problem, and Russia, by the way, isn't doing it because it's a proxy war. Russia can't balance its budget without selling weapons. And it's
right.
A bad commentary that they're in so much trouble, they would rather arm the world and get on the edge of a world war because they can't afford to pay their bills than any other reason. Isn't that an incredible statement about how far Russia has sunk, which makes us call out,
that's
how worried are we about Russia, right?
But let's talk about, and I feel terrible about the Syrian people, you know, what's going on there. And we are funding them, just like just through NATO or whatnot. We're funding the rebels, whoever they are. Russia and China are funding Assad, and everyone knows that. But let's look what happened in Chicago Friday night. 19 people got shot and killed and whatnot. That's as many as some get killed in a firefight in Syria, but no one's talking about Chicago. Well, how about how many people are killed by in America during the in one weekend?
I'll give you a better one, because this was one of our mantras through law school when we were complaining about Vietnam. We would say frequently, that, and it's true, if you look up the statistics, more people were killed a year per year in the middle 70s in car crashes in the U.S. than were died totally in all the years of Vietnam. One year we got up to 58,000 people in the U.S. killed in car accidents. We've actually, through airbags and safety devices, succeeded in reducing that down to about 33,000 people a year in the U.S. That's a huge number of U.S. citizens are killed in automobile accidents. So, yeah, I think that applies across the board, Sam.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, and I really believe if the United States would go back to fortress the United States, yes, have a defense, but stop. What are we doing in all these countries? And, like, all that money could be going to fund the abortion that people need, stem cell research, as you talked about, fix our roads, do all this stuff, help our education. I mean, Manny, that graph you sent me, it's horrifying, that the amount of money being spent to go kill people across the world.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's a point that so many people miss. And I'm not as sympathetic to the Syrians, who have been an awful country for quite some while. They've caused a huge amount of wars and other issues. And Lebanon, for example, they've funded Hamas for years. And the country's politics as a whole, not just their leader, frankly, leave a lot to be desired. But the fact is, this is going to, in many ways, paralyze that country and make them less of a danger in the Mideast than they have been for the last 20 years. And if that costs some lives, as sad as I am about the loss of life, in the bigger picture, it probably helps our country. And it's that, and again, we're down to a point in life where we're rationalizing those issues. But I can tell you that in the atmosphere I grew up in the United States, post-World War II, my brother served in the South Pacific, including Iwo Jima, and I know how he felt. I know how they felt about such issues as, dropping the nuclear bomb on Japan. If every time someone talked about, apologizing, he would go ballistic. He said we should have killed more of them. They were the rottenest, dirtiest bastards in the world when it came to war. So I'm not sure that I'm that sympathetic. But the problem with that is, no, we don't support the rebels because we don't know who they are. The rebels are broken into various conservative groups, and one of the reasons why Obama doesn't want to take any kind of position is he's not sure that those weapons won't go in the hands of the conservatives who are supported by Iran and be funding literally another Taliban that could take over the country. So there's really no one safe to support in the climate right now. And the fact that if you look at the geographical makeup of Syria, it's very hard to deal with Syria, who is far more prepared for these issues than, say, a backwards Tunisia or any of those countries, okay? So here we are. We have a country who's been armed by the Soviet Union with state-of-the-art warfare, and the thought of invading them is absolutely insane. And by the way, if we're going to invade any country, why don't we just get up and invade Mexico? Because they're our biggest problems. It would solve most of the problems with the drug war. We need to depose that government. We've needed to depose that government for as long as I can remember. And you want to change the United States? Forget about the Middle East. Do something about Mexico.
I think Israel can more than well defend itself.
Yeah, well, how about this fact? Ron Paul loves to point this out, and he gets me every single time with it. As you're aware, the U.S. gives more money to the Arab nations in support than it gives to Israel. So we're supporting both sides of the combatants and throwing our money away. Do you know how much money we could save in this country if we cut off foreign aid to Pakistan, the Arab countries, and the rest of them? I mean, the number is just unbelievable.
Oh, the amounts of money that have gone to Pakistan with this war in Afghanistan is mind-boggling.
It's
okay, why the hell are we playing in any of these countries when, you know, we have problems at home? You know, why not?
I wish someone
could
explain that.
Yeah.
Peter, how about you? Do you have a sudden answer for us?
Well, you know, to me, when you have people who are making these policy decisions who don't directly have to pay the price of whatever decision they make, it's easier for them to make certain decisions. If there's political expedience to be gained or some profit motive that they can personally achieve by directing funds elsewhere or making these types of policies, and they're not the ones who directly have to pay the cost, then they seem to invariably do it. I mean, that's just a basic big picture understanding. I have no idea of the subtleties that are involved here, who's benefiting by what policy and why dollars are flowing into the hands of other people. But sooner or later, if you follow the money, you'll get your answer. You'll get your answer in one form or another. I just somebody's benefiting from it, and it's not the people who are paying the price.
You know, generation, wait a minute, and then you can jump in, Simon. My generation has long bemoaned the use of what's called the domino principle, which is the words out of Dwight Eisenhower's mouth when speaking about DMVM Foo in 1954 and touted that the whole world's going to collapse under this domino principle. And my generation has spent the last 50 years trying to prove to everybody that's wrong. And in fact, in the case of Vietnam, it was going to fall anyway. And no matter what we did, we had no chance whatsoever to stop that war. And that's the problem we have. You know, right now the Middle East has histories, 4,000 or 5,000 years of history of having these kinds of wars. They just go on and on and on. That's the nature of who they are, what they do. And invariably, every one of the governments get replaced by a more conservative government. And if anyone thinks the next government in Syria is going to be a liberal government, they're crazy. It won't be.
I mean, just look at what's going on in Egypt. I mean, we scored big. I mean, the good news is we didn't actually create a war. But, I mean, why can't we focus on America rather than spreading our wealth all over the world?
There's several reasons, Simon. Oh, go ahead, someone else. Anyone else want to take that one?
What, Simon's?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to happen because we're out of money. I mean, I think, Simon, I think what you say is there's a lot of people, and Peter, you follow the money line is excellent. We're fighting all these wars. And I'll even go back to you, Manny. The whole domino effect. We fought a guy who helped us defeat the Japanese in World War II, Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh was our ally in fighting the Imperial Japanese Army and all that, and we don't want him to control his country like Mao took over China and everything. We turned on our own allies for what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, and that's what he said, to beware the military-industrial complex, and we haven't. But what's happened is the Republicans who get in the military-industrial complex said they looked the other way while the Democrats said the social issues, and everyone just kept spending money and money and money, and they thought there was going to be oodles of money forever and ever and ever to fund all these programs, defense programs and domestic programs, which haven't worked, and that's why we're out of money. It hasn't worked. The war on poverty hasn't worked. The war on drugs hasn't. We lost that one. We lost that. And we've lost, and now we're losing all these wars because it's costing so much money.
And we have
therefore, I think we
have a severe shrinking middle class. I mean, it's severely
right.
shrinking.
Well, Ashley, tell me your story about Ho Chi Minh.
And that's what's
going
to happen. I think our own spending habits are going to force us to take care of ourselves, Simon.
Ashley, tell me your story about Ho Chi Minh that you repeat to me all the time about when they threw the Japanese out of Vietnam. What happened? What did he do? He had a big celebration, and what did
he celebrate? That was really shocking to me because it was one of the courses that I just took, and I really found it fascinating. And the fact that he was so grateful to the Americans that he had a celebration in which his Declaration of Independence actually mirrored in many ways the United States Declaration of Independence. He took even the opening was almost, a lot of the wording was to honor the fact that he got what we were doing. He got what independence was about. And he even played the Star Spangled Banner. He was so excited when he got the Japanese out. And then he thought, wow, you know, he's got the American support. And, of course, politics came in. And politics said, oh, no, you know, we can't be buddies with him because we got to be buddies with the French colonists. Oh, we got to be buddies with these guys. So it was at the end of World War II. And so subsequently, the United States got the people that that were colonizing the Vietnamese and come back in. So Ho Chi Minh had people, once again, forcing him to be back where he was before, which was not losing their independence. So here's a man who wanted to mirror the United States, and at that point, if somebody would have listened to him and said, geez, look at that, he's playing the Star-Spangled Banner, then a lot of this ideology that was going on of, you know, if we allow Ho Chi Minh to be in charge, then communism is going to take over and every country is going to follow thereafter, then we could have actually won at that point, turning point, to avoid actually ever having a war, which means a lot of Americans would still be alive right now.
Yeah, and you know why we did it for people of interest in history is the government, U.S. government wanted and needed France's support and the issues dealing with Eastern Europe and Italy, or excuse me, and Germany, and especially during the post-World War II occupation period. And de Gaulle would not give us support and lobbied and pressed the point, and if we didn't support him in getting Vietnam back, then he wouldn't have supported us on what we wanted. So it's literally your traditional sellout for, you know, peanuts to another government. We sold out the Vietnamese, and they never really forgave us for it until afterwards.
And Manny, I think one of the biggest points, which Peter said early on, which just hit me, and I keep going back to it, is how ideology plays such an important element in every single issue. Every issue, right down to what we were discussing in the opening of the show with the rape issue. Ideology and, you know, the rape / anti-abortion versus abortion issue, and how ideology will divide people as opposed to allowing people their point of view and actually listening to their point of view and seeing if there's a way to work through that point of view so that people can, human beings can live together. We can live together without war, which would be the ideal situation. But ideology, don't you think, Peter? Ideology is what interrupts.
Human beings can live together? Let's not get crazy here.
Boy, you radical.
Oh, that was real radical.
Whoa, where did that come from?
Civil War is over.
People, you know, I've always had the theory that people, like many forms of life on this planet, are essentially social creatures. They're group animals. And they naturally form groups at every opportunity because it's part of their natural makeup. And once you start forming groups, you start, you know, creating all the things that we consider to be vices of humanity. Once you start forming groups, you get politics. Once you start forming groups, you get hierarchy. And once you start forming groups, you get ideology. And since people have, in my opinion, have an inherent need to want to define themselves by attaching themselves to certain groups or certain ideology, these ideologies necessarily serve as swords and shields with respect to what are perceived to be neighboring or competing ideologies. And they govern our perception of things, and they govern what we do until such time as a more pressing need presents itself, and they suddenly realize that whatever ideology they think is important, it's suddenly not so important in the face of some other greater conflict. And so naturally, it's my perception that this is how everything always works. And so that's a very long-winded way of saying, yes, Ashley, I agree with you. And no, I don't think people can coexist together unless they have some incredible crisis that manifests itself, and suddenly they realize that they have to put aside whatever ideology they have and they have to bond together. And personally, I think we're getting close to that. I'm just not sure when it's going to happen and what it will be and whether or not it will be too late.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever happen because of the great size of the U.S. It's the divide that goes between the areas. It's different needs financially. It's different needs in terms of how, look at the weather this week and how it affects different portions and different interests. So by our very nature, we're going to have a lot of conflicting interests, which incidentally is one of the biggest problems in both China and Russia is the size of the country. But when you come back to all this, we still get down some very, very basic considerations, and that is that the South has not forgiven the end of the Civil War. They'd like to be back to the old days, and every opportunity they have to send government back to the, you know, pre-Civil War days, we have it. And I point out to Sam, and we discuss frequently during the week, how similar this is to the election of 1860 and the wide divide in politics during that year and what led up to the Civil War, because to a great extent, both Sam and I see not only the ingredients of the Civil War, but we also see that as a build-up to World War One. And abortion rights were always an issue, and how you treated pregnant women in those days was really a big issue, because along with that treatment went the fact that they were ostracized and in some areas, and I think the Deep South is really guilty of this, where religious fanaticism arrives, women are still treated poorly because they may get pregnant either intentionally, deliberately, out of wedlock, or in some way that compromises the original goals of what I call the Deep South morality. And you may disagree with me, and I'm sure we have some listeners from the South that are just steaming right now what I said.
Well, Manny, you know, one of the things that gets me, and this really gets me, is that, and I question it all the time, as a Christian, how do you look at somebody and say, do not have an abortion? You're 11 years old, do not have an abortion. This is really wrong. You know, God must have meant for this child to get raped, because that, how else are you going to think, okay? So then this child is going to walk through school. Everybody's going to point a finger. Everybody's going to remember this child in town. This child is going to be so ostracized. Yet, they're raising their children to be these Christians who believe in God, who are anti-abortion, and why are they not supporting every single pregnant woman in the world? You cannot have it both ways. You cannot ostracize somebody. You cannot treat them like they're no longer a virgin, therefore, you know what? You must have done something really bad in your past life because God's punishing you. You cannot have both sides of the fence. And if they're going to say you can't have an abortion, and you're going to have that HIV baby, you know, or you're going to have that gonorrhea baby because you can't have drugs either to protect yourself, guess what? They better be supporting that child, and they better be supporting the child having the child or the adult having the child, and they better support that person in every single aspect. Financially, they better be getting their own wallets out and making sure they support that. And they better do, as Christians, everything they can to psychologically help that person and to teach their children to not point a finger at that little belly growing. And they can't have it both ways.
Ashley, you know, I think that's a great thought, and we're going to wrap our show up on that because I'm looking at the time we're getting towards the end of the show, and I don't know anyone who could say it any better than anyone who takes this position against anti-abortion and the rest of it need to stop and ask themselves, what would they do if their wife or daughter, particularly a very young one, were raped? Would they support it? Would they still be in the side of no abortions if it's their 12-year-old who's been raped by a minority that's different than theirs, whether it's black, green, or yellow, or some hated Eastern European nation like Turkey and Armenians, a Turk raping an Armenian girl would be the same as an interracial one. So the question is, when faced with all of this, what are these people going to do? To end our show, I'm going to suggest that anyone who's against abortion, go spend some time and see what happens to these poor young girls, or a woman of any age, when she undergoes this horribly traumatic experience, and it will open your eyes, and hopefully it will open your heart, too.
I, Sam, do you have any final comments for us? We've got about 90 seconds left.
I just want to thank everybody. It was a great discussion today. I think we're all on the same page in regards to the abortion issue, blessedly. And I think this guy Atkins is a schmuck, and I hope he goes far away. And I hope everybody has a great, great Labor Day weekend.
Okay, and Peter?
All I can think is I wonder if God's punishing me for something I did in a past life.
Right. By getting involved
no,
with
no, 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 just beyond that. But, no, it was a great discussion, and I truly love everyone's comments. It's very exhilarating to hear all of you talk.
And, Ashley, I want to thank you for joining us. You added something to today's program that would have been missing without you.
Oh,
a woman.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for noticing.
Frankly,
if you were Todd Atkins, you wouldn't have noticed, right?
Right.
You know, guys, I say that about my life every time I look at her, so I understand.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you for the...
We will be back next Sunday. Not quite sure quite what our format's going to be, but we will have a program. Till then, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, safe, and healthy day and week. And we will be back. Till next time, goodbye.
Bye.